So now we'll have a period discussion. Anyone would like to ask any questions or anything to contribute? About half an hour, and then we'll have a short break, and then for the final 15 minutes, just sit quietly, meditate until 4 o'clock. That would be the end, the afternoon. If at 4 o'clock anybody would like to go for a walk, I'm happy to take everyone for a walk up to where I live, like we did last time. If you have to be off and back to Bangkok, then never mind. Does anyone have anything they'd like to talk about? Yes.
When you're trying to focus, or rather not focus, just focus on breathing.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden sometimes these thoughts come in, you have an aha moment, and things you didn't, you weren't able to figure out before.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Generally speaking, the best idea is that you don't want to be making decisions about what should I do while you're meditating. Well, you make all your decisions before you start. So, let's say you say, well, okay, I'm really going to give myself to this meditation, and I'm not going to be interested. You know, whatever pops up in my mind, I'm just going to let it go. That's probably the best general advice. But every now and again, you might say to yourself, you might just put a little bit of pen and paper by the side. You think, well, you know, if something comes up in my mind that's really important this time, I'll just jot it down. But generally speaking, I mean, it's you know, if you really want to develop the meditation, then it's better just to forget about that. And usually if it's popped up during the meditation, it'll come back again afterwards anyway, you know, when you try to remember it. But, it, you know, that can very easily lead you, you know, all over the place. You know. Yes. Generally speaking, I think you can compare it with any kind of physical exercise. You know, doing yoga or jogging or whatever. You know, you don't want to go at it push too much at the beginning. You want to take a period of time which is reasonably comfortable, and then gradually extend it. And you know, the time that you extend it to is going to depend on your life and your responsibilities, how much time you have to spare. I mean, if you can, you know, people who are really dedicated may try to do an hour, but that's usually a lot for most people, and half an hour would be reasonable. I would suggest that if you have to choose one period a day, that early morning is the best time. Most people choose to meditate before they go to bed at night, and I don't think that's such a good choice for a number of reasons. One is you're pretty tired already, and maybe you're not going to put your best effort into it at that time of night usually, and very easy to get sleepy at that time. And if you meditate just before you go to bed, and so at the end of the meditation is a bit drowsy and druggy and sort of, you know, then you can get into quite bad habit in meditation that way, until you sort of I knew some people who've sat like that for years, and then when they come to do a course, and they just find that they get sleepy very easily, because it's just kind of sleepiness and meditation just sort of, you know, conjoined in their minds. A very important support, something which will enable you to be consistent in your meditation, which is really the important thing, rather than the length of time you sit at any one time. It's continuity and consistency. And that is to be able to see the beneficial effects in your daily life. Now, if you meditate at night time before you go to sleep, when you wake up, it's like a new chapter of your life, as it were, and it's very difficult to see any knock-on effect from the previous night's meditation, or to feel their effect is being affected by that meditation. Whereas in the morning, you meditate, and then you go to work, or you're fulfilling your duties, and you often see, yes, I can really feel that. I feel a lot more grounded, feel a lot more mindful, aware, sensitive, don't get so easily upset with things. And you begin, you're not looking for really big sort of wow insights and moments, but just a general increase in your quality of life. And it's through seeing that the commitment to keep doing it through the ups and downs that you'll inevitably experience comes about. When you meditate first thing in the morning, your mind's not got a lot of stuff going on. It's quite clear. It's usually well rested and ready to meditate. So I think that's a good thing to do. Now, one of the many things that we're interested in looking at in meditation is the whole experience of time. So that is something that, it's not over and apart from sort of an added kind of perspective on meditation, but it's part of it itself, to see that when we're in pain, when we're in discomfort, when we're suffering, time is experienced as going very slowly. But when we're enjoying ourselves, when we're really committed to something, it goes very quickly. And then we begin to notice just, that our experience of time throughout the day, it doesn't at all follow the smooth circling of the little spot in the middle of the clock. It's just not tick, 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 tick. It's going fast, it's going slow. There's all kinds of variations of tempo during the day. And you begin to see the relationship between time as we experience it, time as it really is, in other words, and our mental states. And so this is one of the insights that come about. So when there's wanting something, that's when time becomes a burden. I haven't put forward my nomination officially, but I'd like to, for the Nobel Peace Prize, my nomination is the man who designed this system at traffic lights where it gives you a countdown. I think that's done more to relieve stress and in the world than almost anything I can think of. Because time, although it's tick, 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 it's exactly the same. When you know exactly how long you've got to wait, you don't get all tense, you see? And time goes quite smoothly. So even see, the more you desire and the more you want, and there's more this gap between your present experience and what you want, time becomes a problem. Think that you say you sit for 5 minutes and you find half an hour's passed. That's wonderful. That's very good. But the other times when 5 minutes seems like half an hour, as the times you just have to be very patient. Sometimes just to say, well, until the time that I've allotted has passed, I'm not going to get up. Even if I feel restless, I feel miserable, it just feels like a waste of time, I'm just going to sit there. And that's the way you learn to meditate through things. Now, one of the differences between meditation in a monastery for monks and for lay people is that for lay people, you tend to, you're sort of good weather meditators generally, like sort of when you feel good and okay, meditate. But then when you have some kind of life crisis and you feel absolutely miserable and upset and anxious and so on, you think, I can't meditate like this, it's just a waste of time, I don't want to do that. And so you don't ever, I'm not saying you, but most people rarely develop this ability just to sit through things. And that's a wonderful quality. It's not like because I feel so messed up and all over the place, it's precisely at those times that you sit. And if you can sit and you experience that, this sort of storm of thoughts and emotions, then it just gradually settling down. And until you feel at peace, then suddenly you realize, wow, I've got something to actually do about this. Rather than running away to try and take a pill or go and see a movie or sort of distract yourself, that these things don't necessarily have to overwhelm you. There is something in you which is not that. It's that there is something that can bear through that and come out the other side. That's a wonderful thing to experience from meditation. So it's not that, when you meditate, you want to be really peaceful, and if you can't, you're a failure. That's not it at all. So quite often, you can learn as much or more from, the unpeaceful meditations as you can from the peaceful ones. Because it's what's going on right now, and that's what you're interested in. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, common sense first, if you're sick, you need to see a doctor and find out what's wrong. If it's not just a passing thing, it's obviously something wrong with you, and then I'm not advocating just meditating with it, But you go and see the doctor, he gives you some medicine, it's going to take some time before it gets better, and during that time you're going to experience some discomfort. But if you can spend some time meditating, which is, not necessarily you have to do it in the sort of the traditional posture, you can be comfortable, and if you're feeling ill, but just bring that attention to the present moment and trying to be with that pain, because many monks have said that they've learned probably some of the biggest lessons that they've learned has been when they've been sick. A lot of we live in the forest, and most of us have been here any length of time, have had various illnesses. I mean, I'm probably one of the healthiest monks around, but I've had malaria and typhoid and leptospirosis and all these things, and it's just kind of part of living in the jungle, and I took medicine for those things. But while you're sick, then it brings up so much stuff, that things that normally you wouldn't get much chance to look at, or maybe you wouldn't look at so well, things like fear of death, anxiety, and just this general aversion to pain and discomfort and illness. You just don't want it to be there, and a lot of the suffering and the things that we sort of call pain, pain is actually like complex phenomena. That there is a physical side to it, but quite often the largest part of the pain we experience is the mental reaction to the physical condition, which is composed of aversion, anger, fear, anxiety, all kinds of things. So when we talk about meditating, we mean bringing mindfulness to that experience and letting go of the mental reaction to it, to the extent we find that the physical component is often quite minor and something that we can bear with quite easily. As far as specific techniques are concerned, dealing with pain, then looking at pain and taking pain as a meditation object, particularly looking at its location. Is it of a fixed location in the body, or is there a certain amount of movement? Is it coming like in waves? Is it constant? What's the nature of the pain? You know, there's so many different kinds of pain. There's burning pain, stabbing pain, all these different kinds of pain. There's the intensity of the pain is unlikely to be constant. So you're looking at location, characteristic, intensity, and just looking at it in that way, and you become where it's an impermanent phenomena. It doesn't have an owner. It's part of nature, and a lot of wisdom can arise from that. A different way of dealing with pain is not the sort of the wisdom side, using the analysis side, but developing the positive emotion, like loving kindness. Just sending thoughts of loving kindness to the particular part of the body which is affected, and just bathing it in loving kindness. And then you can use the breath in conjunction with that. So feeling that imagining that you're breathing through that organ, that particular part of the body that hurts, breathing through, breathing in, breathing out through the organ with this sense of kindness and love. And that's a way of dealing with the, again, with all the negative emotions. It replaces them with its opposite. So you see, when you have all this negative, all this attachment and negative mental reaction, you have different strategies that you can employ. One is by giving the mind this work of wisdom and analysis to do, so that the mind is so intent on its analysis that it doesn't have the time to worry and to feel fearful and so on. Or else you replace the negative emotion with the positive emotion. So you have two choices that you find which is the best one to employ for you at that particular time. Okay. Yes? Yes. It's the way that I like to talk about the religions of the world. If you consider religions as belonging to families, like the main family that we're aware that we know in the West is the family of religions that grew up in the Middle East: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and these are religions of the book, and they are faith religions. Indeed, these days the word faith is often used as a substitute for religion. More and more, you say the Christian faith, the Muslim faith, or in England they talk about faith communities, faith schools, all these kinds of things. So this points very clearly to the central role of faith in those religions. And you can only be a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew if you have a strong faith in those books and in their holy books and in those religions. Doubt is somewhat feared and criticized. You know, you don't want to doubt. Don't doubt. Whatever you do, don't doubt. You know, faith is this absolute that you have to care for. So I would summarize these religions as belief systems. Okay, and we're so used to the idea of a religion as a belief system in the West that people are kind of confused by Buddhism, or just imagine that all religions are basically the same. They're all just different religious, different belief systems, whereas Christians believe that Jesus died for your sins, Muslims believe there's only one God, his name's Allah, his prophet is Muhammad, and so on. Then Buddhism believe in Buddha, something like this. But that's completely not the case. So I would characterize the religions that grew up in India, most particularly Buddhism, as an education system rather than a belief system. So it's a very different concept, an idea of what a religion is and what the function of a religion is, and your relationship to the religion. So the Buddhism doesn't start off with ideals and dogmas and metaphysics. It starts off with some basic hypothesis, if you like, or propositions about human existence. You know, and it says, we as human beings lack any real and lasting happiness. And there is a cause for that. The cause is that we don't understand the way things are. We don't understand ourselves. Simultaneous with the lack of knowledge or the inevitable outcome of this ignorance of the way things are various kinds of cravings and attachments. So, and the Buddha says that there is such a thing as true lasting happiness and completion and liberation, and it is achieved through the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is the education of every aspect of our lives, our relationship to the physical world, our relationship to the social world, training and of abandonment of negative emotions, development of positive emotions, and ultimately the development of wisdom and understanding. So religious life is considered in terms of this education, training of every aspect of our life as a human being here and now. So, in Buddhism, we make a very important distinction, and it has a very beautiful term. We call it caring for the truth, or Satchanuraka. And that means being very careful to distinguish between direct experience or knowledge and belief. So, if you're a Buddhist, then you can have various kinds of beliefs, and many beliefs are considered to be very useful beliefs, and that they help support this education process. If you take those on as working hypothesis, in other words, but at the same time, you must always remember that your faith and your belief in certain propositions is not yet true knowledge, as long as it's not direct experience. So people say, oh, you're a Buddhist, do you believe in rebirth? You see, that's not really the real point of it, you see. Because Buddha says, well, yes, I do believe in rebirth, but I haven't proved it for myself. You always have to remember that. It's just a belief. Yeah, I believe it, and I have various good reasons for believing in it. I believe in it because of the teachings in the Tripitaka, teachings of the Buddha, been recorded in the Tripitaka. I believe it because of the memory of past lives of many great meditators and monks. I believe it because of hypnosis, because of spontaneous memories of past lives amongst children all over the world. These are all quite reasonable grounds for belief in rebirth, I would say. But at the same time, if you don't have that direct experience, and you can't remember your own past lives, it's only a belief. It's not true. Whereas in many religious systems, you have people say, this is true. I know it's true. And you say, well, how do you know it's true? It's because I believe. I just believe so strongly. You know, to the extent that the strength of your belief is a proof that what you believe must be true. And so it goes round. I believe because it's true. It's true because I believe it. It's kind of circular reasoning. And as long as people are caught up in that way, then I can fully see why so many people in the Western world feel that the major obstacle to world peace is religion, because belief systems are, I believe, a great obstacle to world peace. Because if you believe that the only way that you can get to heaven is believing in something, then you must logically consider everyone who doesn't believe what you believe is not going to heaven, they're going to hell. So immediately you have a dilemma. If all these people are going to hell, what are you going to do about it? What's your responsibility? You know? This seems to be built into the structure of belief systems. Whereas in Buddhism, you see, people will go to heaven dependent on how they've lived their life. You know, if you've lived a good life, you've been moral, you've been kind, you've helped other people, you have all these good qualities, you've lived a good life, then you've created the causes and conditions to go to heaven. Whether you're a Christian, you're a Muslim, you're a Jew, you're an atheist, you're whatever, that's irrelevant. What you believe is not the primary conditioning factor for whether or not you go to heaven after you die. It's how you lived your life. So I feel that Buddhism, you know, has something it can really give the world, and this ability to believe, you can believe, you know, but how can you not see that however strong you believe something, that's not really knowing, and there's a difference between knowing and believing. And I think that if that one point could be accepted, then there might be some way out of this deadlock between all the, you know, the different religious systems. But I'm not particularly optimistic, but I'm just offering this as a reflection. Yes. How do you know when you know? yeah, you know. but sometimes you don't always know. Sometimes you know that you don't know. On the higher levels of practice, let's say in Buddhist practice, levels of enlightenment, there's four levels of enlightenment, then it is very easy, and many people do overestimate their attainments. And for this reason, you know, there are certain, one would go to see one of the great elders. So in a forest monk, let's say on retreat in a cave or somewhere, has this very strong meditation experiences, then he would go to a great master and tell him and let him know and ask him, you know, whether this is authentic. So I guess some, you know, of course, you know, I can guess, you know, the question here is, well, how do you know he's really enlightened? And at a certain level, yes, you do have to take that on trust. But the, you know, there are certain you know, there are certain things which, you know, will give you that kind of confidence. I mean, say in the ability of great monks to talk about the nature of the mind in quite amazingly profound ways. Many of them have the ability to read people's minds, which is quite impressive, although it's not actually a proof in itself that person has. But yes, I would say on that level, then you're dependent on the Tripitaka and on the on one's trust in the attainments of this small band of great monks. On a slightly lower level, I think that one important teaching of the Buddha is the harmony, the relationship between the inner and the outer. And the Buddha is referred to as Vijjācharana Sampanno, one who's perfected in wisdom and conduct. And so the idea being that purity of mind is inevitably expressed in conduct. And that as someone becomes more spiritually mature, then certain kinds of conduct become impossible for them. It's no longer a matter of them refraining from certain kinds of conduct as being immoral, wrong. but the actual intention in their mind to perform that action can no longer appear. So this is sort of the highest level of inner virtue, where there's no longer that kind of action. So after certain level of spiritual maturity, even the very intention to harm another being or to tell a lie, for instance, becomes impossible for that person. It's completely automatic. Until higher levels, then every kind of sexual thought will completely disappear, and that is an inevitable result of the higher levels of spiritual practice, according to the way the Buddha taught. So all interest and desire for fulfillment in the sensual world starts to atrophy and eventually disappears. So there are certain results that can be noticed externally, and this is in the respect in which Theravada Buddhism, this form of Buddhism, differs somewhat from some other schools of Buddhism and some other Eastern religious traditions. The idea is that the enlightened being is beyond good and evil, and he can do anything. And you can't apply the same standards to him anymore, because he's beyond all that. You're just applying your very limited perspective to someone who's living in an unlimited realm. Whereas the Buddha taught, and at least as I understand it, that the responsibility of the enlightened being is to be a moral exemplar. And even though he doesn't have to keep all these rules and these moral standards, he does anyway, out of compassion for his disciples and for people of future generations. So you have in our generation, we have Lumbu Man, who was the sort of founder of this modern forest tradition, and he was incredibly strict with the rules and regulations of the forest monk, not because he needed them to go against his cravings, but out of respect for the tradition. Because if you're practicing after a while, you can very easily say, I don't need to do that anymore. It's not a problem for me anymore, you see. And you can easily delude yourself and you say, I don't need to do that anymore. But then you think, well, Lumbu Man did that till the last day of his life, and he's so much more advanced than me, so how can I say that I don't need to do it? So this is the way that these great teachers, are giving to people of the future generations. You don't have any way that you can say I don't need to do that anymore. So the idea is that if someone is in the Theravada tradition, if someone claimed to be a great enlightened master and was having affairs with all his female students, you would say, that guy's a sham. Don't believe it. Don't believe it's possible. Because he couldn't even have the intention to indulge in that kind of behavior if he was truly enlightened. It's not possible. So although some things, you can't see, inner spiritual life, and often personality, you see, doesn't change. Someone who's been bumbling, inarticulate, as a unenlightened being will become a bumbling, inarticulate arahant. Someone who's very charismatic will become a charismatic arahant. But it doesn't mean that you become enlightened, you get an enlightened personality. That's you just see personality is just that. It's not who you are. Mm. Yes. Speech, yes.
You talk about the Eightfold Path.
Yes.
And watching myself and others interacting in the world seems to be one of the most problematic areas.
Yes.
Speech. Mm. Anyway, if you can give some guidance on sort of 10 practices.
Yes. I think it's really important, and something many meditators, even many monks, overlook. But if you meditate on a regular basis, ask yourself how many times when stuff comes up in your mind is because of things you've said or other people have said to you. I mean, just how much of an obstacle it is. Also, many people, I don't have time to meditate, I've got such a busy life and everything. But if you look at practice in terms of the Eightfold Path, you say, well, yeah, leading a busy life, well, then, you know, you can develop right speech. You know, that's your challenge, to develop right speech. And it's a real, really difficult practice because, you know, you often don't have time just to gather yourself and to form a, and often, you know, you're with somebody and maybe it starts off quite wholesome and then, you know, it's sort of gradually slippery slope, you know, suddenly, you know, you're talking in quite unwholesome ways. There are certain helpful guides here. I spoke before about precepts as being pegs for mindfulness. So, you know, it's not this kind of system or these things that you have to follow, you have to believe, you get rewarded if you keep the precepts, punished if you don't. But these are training rules. It means that they're ways to help you educate your speech. And so you have to recollect these. And so it's like they're right in the forefront of your mind, you know, refraining from lying, from speaking coarsely, from speaking divisively, criticizing one person to another person behind their backs, and speaking rubbish and just pointless gossip. Of course, with the fourth one, I mean, that's, you know, almost impossible, and you know, you have to be a little bit more relaxed about that. Obviously, somebody's feeling depressed and sick, and you know, you're not going to be talking about really high and elevated stuff. You just want to cheer them up, maybe tell them a few jokes and chat. So, you know, I can't tell a joke. I know I'll be it's not breaking a precept or something. I mean, sometimes it's common sense and compassion is going to be more important. But the one about lying, that in itself is a wonderful practice. And I think it's quite sobering when you take that on as a spiritual practice. You know, I make a real effort not to tell a lie. Just how often you do tell lies? You know, you think, I know I don't tell lies. You know, but when you, yes, it's quite interesting, you know, to see just how often we do. Now, a common objection here is, what about white lies? You know, somebody says, how do you like my dress? You know, and you, what do you say? You know, and so there's a kind of, you know, this kind of idea that, you know, there's a conflict here. You know, you either tell the truth or you hurt somebody's feelings. So I tell a lie so I don't hurt somebody's feelings. But when you take this precept on, then, you know, the question is, how can I not hurt this person's feelings and not tell a lie at the same time? See, then it becomes a real challenge. Is it possible to do that? And you start to develop skillful means and skillful means of speech. But the five, ten characteristics, I'll give you five characteristics. Five characteristics of good speech, we call supasita. One, it's true. Second, it's a benefit to the person that you're speaking to. Third, it's the right time and place. Fourth, that you're speaking with goodwill and kindness. And fifth, that you're speaking politely. Politely, yes. So those are the five factors, you see. So, this is one of these things you can do. I don't know if you know what algorithms are. I'm really into algorithms, and like for spiritual life, algorithms are really good. So you can develop this with these like five factors, like true, beneficial, timely, kind, polite. So then you've got untrue, see, what's the second one? Not beneficial, not timely, and then unkind and unpolite. So sometimes when somebody speaks to you, you know, and one way of just sort of distancing yourself from the visual emotional impact, just take it in these five, okay, yeah, so that was actually true, actually quite beneficial, you know, probably not quite the right time and place for me. You're not very kind. And so when just that effort, just to sort of look at it in those terms, can just sort of take the sting out of it. Being mindful of your body is very important, because body affects mind, mind affects body. Now, what happens when this may be unkind speech or some kind of impact on us? There is the impact on our understanding and our thought, and there's also a physical impact. Sometimes we can be physically shaken up by something. Now, what happens if you're mindful? Then some sort of negative thought may come up, and you can let go of that. You say, that don't think, just let go. But because there's the physical effect is more lasting than the mental effect, you can still feel physically shaken up, that you let go of that thought, and then that physical feeling stimulates a new wave of thought, and it comes back again. And then maybe the second time you just get caught with it and follow it. So that keeping just grounded in the physical sense, how does it feel physically? Where does it feel like this? And just being totally with that, and just being relaxed with it, just being there with the physical discomfort. And just if you can just kind of imbue it with a sense of acceptance and letting go, then you're dealing with it both in the mental and the physical side at the same time. And most strong emotions are like that. Anger's like that, fear's like that, anxiety is like that. You can't just sort of get rid of it with the thoughts. You have to be dealing with the physical manifestation at the same time. So, with hurtful speech, then these are techniques to use. Also, it must be said that with speech and communication, good intentions are not enough. There's things that you can learn, particular ways of speaking and particular helpful and unhelpful ways of speaking. Modern psychology is quite good on these things. For instance, you have an argument, don't let it get to the universal level. Always keep it down right to the issue at hand. So if somebody says, "Oh, I'll meet you, at 2 o'clock outside the bookstore or something," and it's 3 o'clock and they still don't come, and then they finally get here and you say, "You're always like this. You're so unpunctual. You're this and you're that. Here we go again." So it's like, so somebody, the other person is being confronted with this sort of universal condemnation of who they are. And no one's going to put up with that, because it's never going to be totally fair. And so you get this argument. What do you do? You make it clear that, what you can say, which is you're not up for dispute, is how you're feeling. You say, "Look, just check first of all. Did you remember that we arranged to meet at 2 o'clock? If we arranged to meet at 2 o'clock and you don't come to 3 o'clock, I just like you to know that it makes me really angry and disappointed, and I really would like you to be on time in future." Okay, and that's very different from saying, "Here we go again. You're always like this. You're so unreliable." And you see. So this is not just a matter of being mindful. These are some particular kind of techniques, applying some attention to just exactly how you speak and how to speak in such a way that some person can take it on board. You don't want to just to sort of, in the long run, you might just sort of let off a bit of steam, but it's not going to do anything for your relationship in the long run. How can you do this so that person is actually going to be willing to change in future? If he thinks that you're just sort of hitting him with a big stick, then it's not going to work very well. So, coming down to how you feel, when you did this at that time, I felt like this. Did you realize that? You know, and what you would like, you can express. So I would like this to happen. You know, if it's possible. Yes. Yeah. Just go to the toilet. Go to the toilet, sit in the toilet, watch your breath for 2 or 3 minutes, and then go back and start again. Just, you know, short break. You know, another good practice is with telephones, you know. Don't pick the telephone up straight away. You know, just take 3 breaths before you pick up a telephone. Start string. I mean, that person's going to wait, you know, they're not going to just abandon the phone call because you wait for 10, 20 seconds. But then, you know, you've stopped and you're ready to be mindful on the phone. You know, you're ready, I'm so sorry, I'm on my way, you know, where am I? Yeah, I'm sitting on the train, you know, sort of whatever. Yeah. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are so many different meditation techniques, and it's a matter, you know, try to find the one that suits you. That's the main thing. One you enjoy doing, and the one that you can keep with. Of course, you know, teaching a large group of people, you just have to choose one. Otherwise, you know, get too confusing for everybody. But yes, that hand movements is very good because, you know, gives you something to do, and to begin with, that's nice. So. Yes, that's it. Lumpur Tien, his name is Lumpur Tien, yes. There are some books in English by him, and one of his Western disciples, Ajahn Gina Wongso, is a friend of mine who used to live at Wat Nanachat, and then he joined this group and he teaches that. So there are people around who are teaching it. And, exactly, yes. I mean, we talk about wisdom developing concentration and concentration developing wisdom. It means, you see, you can either start off with a very simple technique, which is a non-thinking technique, you know, like staying with the breath, or perhaps using mantra or something like this, until the mind gets peaceful, and then it could develop the wisdom side of things more. But you can also start off with a thinking meditation, you know. So it's not that you don't have, you know, meditation means not thinking, but you have to think in quite a systematic way, and you have to sort of think it out beforehand, even to write it down on a piece of paper, that you take certain themes and you go through them one by one. Or, for instance, you take the hair of the head, or hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, and just try and think about the nature of hair and what it's like, and how it's impermanent, how it's not really you, how it's the hair that you see, it's dead already, you cut it off, what's it like? Just imagine all your hair just on the floor in front of you, what would it be like? So thinking about hair in terms of impermanence, impersonality, think of it in terms of the four elements, that kind of way of thinking can calm the mind, until the mind will then just naturally go with the breath, stay with the breath. So thinking about one part of the physical body, or you can develop There's meditations on like verbal meditations on the qualities of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, of the Sangha, or you can meditation that I recommend for people seriously ill or on their deathbed who've never meditated before, is just to recollect the good things they've done in their life. You know, if you're a nurse or a child, a son or daughter, just encourage them to try to think of 3, 4, 5, even 10 things that they're very proud of in their life. And then you go through them one by one. You say, number one. And then you encourage them to think about that for about 3 minutes. And then you can go on to number two and number three. And that kind of sense of rapture and piti and joy and remembering the goodness that one's done can flash out all the negative thoughts and anxieties much more successfully than staying with the breath, which for people who've never done it before and people who are in a lot of pain is almost impossible. So there's a huge number of meditation exercises, you know, and it's not like there's one that's right and, you know, this is the best. You know, it's a matter of trying things out and seeing what works. Okay, it's 4 o'clock. If that's the last of the questions, if you'd like to stretch your legs for 5 minutes and then just have a short sitting to end the session this afternoon, so please.